Donalena Kitchen talks about food. Donalena Kitchen talks recipes. Donalena Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donalena Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donalena Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigo.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Oh, the holidays keep creeping up, and maybe we aren't able to gather in large groups right now, but three cheers to all the folks that are putting up holiday lights. The neighborhoods are twinkling, and there is heartfelt holiday cheer out there despite everything. People get out there, blow up Santa Clauses and their Grinches, and we all feel a little better for it. Who would have thought? But thanks to all the people that decorate thing. I like that. All the decorated lights for Christmas. Well, Donna's going to talk a little bit about preparing for Christmas here. Donna, talk about eggnog.
I have to say, okay, I was sitting down looking at fruitcakes and eggnogs last night and looking through recipes and this and that, and I finally had a psychological breakthrough of how to deal with the holidays this year, because usually my mind is, okay, there's solstice, there's Christmas, there's New Year's, there's, you know, ample opportunities, and I try to structure menus and who's going to be what, where, when, and, you know, obviously that is not happening this year. And so I was kind of like, well, what should I make? What do I want to make? I want to do something, because for me, at least, you know, and I'm sure many of us, doing is part of this whole seasonal spirit. No matter which holidays you're celebrating, it's a, you know, there's giving and taking, and this is like, you know, one more step beyond Thanksgiving as it were. So last night I decided I am just going to randomly make whatever I want. And if I make too much of it, which I probably will, there's going to be deliveries to different friends and neighbors, and it's not going to be on any time schedule. So, Lana, don't expect your Christmas present on Christmas. It's just going to come maybe in drips and drabs. So last night I made fruitcake. Ta-da! I had been working on it a couple of days. We talked last week about making orange peels. So, of course, that is an ingredient for fruitcake. At least my fruitcakes. I try to, you know, I don't want my fruitcakes to be like the usual door stoppers, as they say. So I have there's a recipe in The Joy of Cooking. It's called Fruitcake Coquaigne, C-O-C-K-A-I-G-N-E. And it's basically a pound cake batter that you add in the fruits and the nuts, kind of thing like that. So picking your fruits and nuts are what makes your pound cake different from everybody else's. So you want something bright and sharp. So I put a lot of dried cherries in mine, but the cherries were so dry that I soaked them in bourbon for 24 hours before I put them in. And then I did pineapple, and then I did my orange peels. And nuts. I did, I toasted the nuts first. So I did almonds, hazelnuts, and pecans, I think. Or maybe it was walnuts. I can't remember. So I made the cakes last night, and then I used bourbon on it this year. I'm doing Iowa bourbon. So I would recommend this to make your fruitcake using... You can use your own favorite pound cake recipe if you want. You just add in a lot of fruits and nuts. And then, of course, seasoning is your choice. I used coriander, black pepper, and cinnamon, but not regular cinnamon. I used Ceylon cinnamon. So for me, I don't want it to scream. It's not a spice cake. It's a fruit and nut cake. So I highly recommend this Joy of Cooking recipe. It's 4 cups of flour, 1/4 cup of nut, no, 1 1/2 cups of nuts, 1.5 cups of, that she uses raisins, just baking powder, a lot of butter, a lot of sugar, and a lot of eggs. So it was, if you lay it out by steps, you know, like I think for my cherry, soaking them in advance was worked really well, and the pineapple too. So you just throw it all together, bake it up, and pour the bourbon on. Good. There you go with your fruitcake. Done. Boom. Off the list. The other holiday flavor that is, of course, required is eggnog. Now, of course, anybody can go to the store and buy eggnog, but it does not, it's not the same thing. Most of the eggnogs in the store I find too sweet for my tastes. And homemade eggnog is really simple. Here's the caveat, though. I make my homemade eggnog with using Lana's eggs, which I know don't have any salmonella in them. So I use them raw. And the simple way to make eggnog is to simply put milk and cream, pinch of salt, a pinch of fresh ground nutmeg, and a little bit of cinnamon, not too heavy, with the sugar to taste, and the raw eggs into a blender and just turn it on and whip it. It comes really, it's very quick. If you want to get more elaborate than that, you could whip the cream and fold it in, or you could separate the eggs and whip the egg whites and fold them in at the end. Also, I think a rule of thumb is to remember, if you're going to serve the eggnog with alcohol, you might want a little, you know, the cream and the milk ratio is highly variable. So, you know, suit yourself. Like this early in the season, I'm using more milk than cream because I'm not ready to get fat yet, right? So,
wise choice.
Yeah, because I'll keep making this eggnog for weeks, probably. I love eggnog. If you only have access to eggs that need to be cooked, like if you're buying them at the normal grocery store, which I would cook them. Now, I am not a food scientist, and if anybody has definitive information about this, please let me know. But I did read online that apparently if an egg has salmonella in it, it is in the yolk and not in the white. I don't want to spread internet misinformation, but that's what I read. And most of the recipes that I looked at for cooked eggs actually did only cook the yolks. So what you're for the base of the eggnog, what you want to do is heat your milk, separate your eggs, beat the yolks up. When the heated milk is, then you start to, you temper it just like you would for the base of ice cream or zabouillon. You're making a cream, a white cream sauce, sweet. So you temper by putting a little of the milk into the eggs, and then you eventually put all the milk into the eggs, and then you re-cook it. That way you will get your eggs up to the temperature. You're making like a runny kind of pudding, basically, is what you're making. And then you can add more milk, and then you can add in the whipped egg whites afterwards. So if you have to cook your eggs, you can do that. But I would say making your own homemade eggnog is really lots of fun. And I was reading somebody else who said, this is for a party. Now, we're not having parties this year, but in case we ever have parties again, this is a good idea. If you're having a party and you want to serve eggnog, make a big batch and don't put the alcohol in. Put, because some people like brandy, some people like bourbon, some people like whiskey. So this hostess was saying that she made a big batch of eggnog and then she put the booze on the table around it so everybody could make their own, and then also the children could drink it without alcohol. So if we ever have parties again, I think I'm going to try that. So I would encourage you to begin now and make your own homemade eggnog right in the blender, lickety split, and let's have the holidays begin.
Very good. Well, I'm in the mood now. That's good. Good. So, Hannah, it looks like we're going to have a new administration. With that change comes a new appointments to the many different cabinet posts, administration, departments, and one way or another affect us all. This could be a good time to think hard about what we want our future to look like. Let's talk about food and agriculture. Joining us today around our kitchen table are Jan and Neil Flora.
Yeah, I had seen this op-ed in the New York Times a couple of days ago, and I went, oh, yeah, whoa, because here in Iowa, we're all waiting to see who's the Secretary of Agriculture going to be. So it was titled, Goodbye USDA, Hello Department of Food and Well-Being. And it was written by Mark Bittman, who is a well-known food writer, and Ricardo Salvador, who is he directs the Food and Environmental Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And also Ricardo is a former ISU professor, and he's kind of one of our homeboys. We all really enjoy him when we get to hear from him. So I called Jen and Neil, and we were talking about this, and I thought we should have something about this on the show. So I'm going to let Jan and Neil, they are our preeminent rural sociologists here, and they're going to introduce themselves. But I just want to start with this one bit. The beginning paragraph was from the op-ed was, with just one cabinet appointment, President-elect Joe Biden could tackle economic inequality, the rural-urban divide, climate change, the growing mistrust of science, systemic racism, and even the coronavirus. That appointment is the Secretary of Agriculture. So Jan and Neil, please introduce yourselves and let's have a go at this topic.
Mute myself. Okay, I'm Cornelia Butler Flora. My official title is Charles F. Curtis, Distinguished Professor of Agriculture and Sociology, Emerita. And I'm also a research professor at Iowa State, and I'm also a research professor at Kansas State University. And somehow, even being emerita, we managed to keep totally busy. We were revising our textbook, Rural Communities, Legacy and Change, for the sixth edition. And with all the changes that have hit us, have made us very much more aware of rural areas, rural agriculture, and its importance of the whole food system and health system.
And I'm Jan Flora. I'm emeritus rather than emerita, sociology professor at Iowa State, and I was also involved in the extension program, the community development program at Iowa State. And I just wanted to hit a few of the highlights of what Mark Bittman and Ricardo Salvador talk about in their op-ed in the New York Times. One of the points they make at the very beginning is that the U.S. Department of Agriculture really is in the food business, because two-thirds of their $146 billion annual budget goes to nutrition and food security. And they say that under normal circumstances, in recent years, we've had over 10% of the population that is food insecure. Nice. And the estimates are that that has probably doubled during COVID. So those are really serious issues.
Right. And this is, so we're talking food stamps here, basically, is a big part of their budget, right?
Yeah, that's the largest portion of that nutrition part. And they also provide assistance to rural communities in terms of rural development, which is my near and dear to my heart. And their argument is that those are not really, that effort is not really integrated into the other things that the Department of Agriculture does. And what we really need is a coalition of farmers, rural people, and urban consumers, and I guess that pretty much covers most of us.
Well, certainly in Iowa.
Yeah. The other point they make as a counterpoint to this idea that food is central to the USDA is that only about 20% of our agricultural land is devoted to raising food. Now, it would be higher than that if you counted the feed that goes into the bellies of livestock that we eat.
That are raised in confinement.
Yeah. But the main point is that we really have sort of two divergent parts of USDA, and they need to be more integrated. And so that means that the agricultural part really needs to focus more on food. And that's why they recommend calling it the Department of Food and Well-Being rather than the Department of Agriculture.
And Vilsack once said, "We don't raise food in agriculture in Iowa. We raise industrial inputs." And I'm afraid that is what we're doing. So we have departments in our major universities figuring out what are more uses for corn and soybeans.
Plastics, for example. Ethanol. Yeah, right.
It's amazing. The names of things are extremely important. The idea that agriculture is, we think about agriculture now as commodities and not food things. And by calling it a Department of Food and Well-Being, all sorts of possibilities just might open up. That's a good suggestion. I like that.
Well, Lana was showing me an article by Jim Hightower where he refers to Abraham Lincoln, who used to call the USDA the People's Department.
Yeah, the USDA was started by Abraham Lincoln in 1862, and it was, you know, it's important. It did forests and conservation and consumers and serve the poor and food stamps it's stuff that we all have a stake in.
And I think it was easier in those days, in one sense, because a very large proportion of the population was engaged in agriculture.
Yes.
Probably, I would guess around Lincoln's time, probably 60 to 70%. It was 90% in George Washington's days. But the other point that they make is that that era, that period of the date of 1862.
Keep your century
1962
straight.
Seems a long time ago, too. In that year, they also passed the Homestead Act. And the Homestead Act we always think of as a very democratizing phenomenon. But in fact, it negatively impacted two important groups. African Americans and Native Americans. We took about 270 million acres of land from the indigenous people in this country to have the Homestead Act, and African Americans were prohibited from taking advantage of the Homestead Act, and of course that was the very time at which African Americans were being liberated, and a central issue about their becoming full citizens, of course, included the right to vote, but just as important as that was having a source of income and especially of wealth.
Access to the land. Yeah.
The low wealth character of the average African-American family is in part due to the fact that we didn't ever really satisfy that thirst for land that they had.
Yeah, while most of our grandparents were scuttling out to the Midwest to begin their farms, which we have all inherited over multiple generations, a lot of people were excluded from that, a lot of American people, just because they weren't white.
And the land grant system also took up about 11 million acres, our authors say, in terms of the land grants that were then used to fund these fledgling experiments in teaching research and extension that they ultimately became.
Yeah, of which ISU was the very first one, right?
Well, we were at Kansas State before, and they dispute that. Michigan State disputes it. But yeah, we were one of the first ones.
And I'm an alumna of both UC Berkeley and Cornell University. And both of those universities are doing something very interesting right now, which is discovering what being a land grant actually meant and whose land was taken, whose land, not just whose land they're on, because Cornell University had a whole lot of Midwestern land, as did UC Berkeley. This land that was then alienated from the indigenous people, it was so-called government land, but it really belonged to the tribes who were actually managing it quite well, keeping good soil, allowing grazing of buffalo. All of that then was lost because when you made it a land grant, then it could be sold. And then when it was sold, that's what the money came back to the universities. And Ezra Cornell, who thought the land had established his university before that, but said, oh, hey, this is a good deal, also personally bought a lot of that land and then resold it. So it was a source of profit for some of these land grant university administrators as well. So this is not a, so it makes me a lot more uncomfortable about every university I've been associated with has been a land grant university. And now I was thrilled for the education, but now concerned about how did it get there and what is happening to the indigenous people today who could have been part of it.
So one of the last points that Bittman and Salvador make is that this orientation toward cash crops means that those crops have to be processed before they can be utilized. And the record of the USDA is not very good with respect to protecting of farm workers either. And so perhaps one of the most important events in that regard is that during the New Deal, when they established the National Labor Relations Act, there were two occupations that were excluded from the wage and hour protections that other workers had under the NRLA. And that was agricultural workers and domestic workers.
Yeah, if I remember the history correctly, those two groups were excluded because otherwise they would have been unable to get the Southern senators to pass the New Deal legislation. Mm-hmm. So once again, let's cut the women and the
minorities.
Minorities out.
Yeah, so that was a direct the so-called Solid South, which probably most people don't know what it is now. It's it's a solid Republican, but it used to be solid Democratic. The Solid South was really consolidated by the Civil War, and because when I was a youngster, the congressional committees were, the committee heads were determined strictly on seniority, and the Southern members of Congress tended to stay in office longer than the Congress was dominated by Southern senators, and that was definitely senators and congresspeople, and that was definitely the situation during the New Deal, which helps explain why why we ended up with the exclusion of farm workers and domestic workers.
And this all comes back to our food systems and how we pay for food, how we grow food, how we distribute food, who gets it, who doesn't. And there we are, back to a thing called the USDA. I want to take a little time here to mention this is KHOI. You're listening to the Donalana Kitchens. This is Tasty Radio. And we will come back and talk with Jan and Neil Flora much more about the food system around us. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. That was a little bit of French-Canadian music there, played by the Barn Owl Band. That was the Gaspé Rio. Well, we are talking about food and, of course, food and agriculture and how the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture, kind of tries to tie this all together. And there have been changes over the past administration, and these changes perhaps need to be undone. I have a quote here from Robert Kennedy. He noticed that how hard progress is. Quote, he says, "Progress is nice, but its agent is change, and change has enemies." So, Neil, Jan, let's talk about changes and how this relates to food and agriculture.
I'm going to talk about some changes in USDA that have been made in the last 4 years that have had very negative impacts on rural areas. And I'm not saying things should go back to exactly the way they were before, but there are things, the issues that need to be addressed. For instance, the position of undersecretary in charge of rural development was eliminated and reduced to assistant secretary position, which was not subject to Senate confirmation, so you could put any loyalist in there. And the Antitrust Regulatory Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyard Administration, GIPSA, was combined with the Agriculture Marketing Service. Those are two very, very different functions.
It was very sneaky, and it's a big deal. Can you elaborate on that? I mean, it sounds very convoluted, but it's very important in the food system.
Yes, and because the Agriculture Marketing Service collaborates with the in multinational corporations who seek, frankly, to export what we produce.
And maximize their profits, right?
And maximize their profit. And what we're seeing, I think many people who raise cattle these days are really feeling taken advantage of. Price of beef is way up. Price you get for your cattle is way down. There is absolutely the consolidation that we've seen in the meat industry was bad before, but now is terrible. And frankly, two of our major meat processors are owned offshore. So that, yes, they're all produced there, but the profits, and by the way, the payments from are going to those owners.
Because right. Our federal tax dollars are going to Brazil, to China, to various places, especially meat companies that are not owned by American corporations.
Right. And American corporations may be stockholders, but there was a time when these moved in, took over what were then going on. So this is really important, not just for how we view our meat industry, because one of the problems that we're having is since we're exporting so much, we raise everything in concentration, which has huge impacts on water and on soil. And
especially here in Iowa.
And the what our local hog farmers often do is they have built a hog hotel, they have built a lagoon for hog waste, they have substituted water for labor in cleaning out the soils, our stalls, which where the pigs stay their entire lives, but for pigs to stand on cement, pigs are actually digging animals. And back in the olden days, pigs had really sharp front paws so they could dig. At Iowa State, we bred flat-footed hogs that could stand up on cement.
No.
So we have this odd, the infrastructure and the waste is owned, and therefore the liability for the waste is concentrated in the farmer, whereas the hogs and the profit or losses, mainly the profit or the subsidies, goes to the corporation. And one of the other issues there is that we have lost local control over what happens in land use. There's a very interesting principle of subsidiarity, which actually comes from Catholic social doctrine, but makes a lot of sense and was actually partially part of our founder's idea, which is decisions are best made by the people nearest who are going to feel the impact of those decisions. And we used to have counties deciding on land use. That has now changed. The state said, oh, wait, under Governor Brand said, they said, no, we can't let counties make those decisions. We'll make those at the state level, which means we're seeing more and more problems of concentration of confined animal feeding operations, which have huge impacts on water quality that can't be controlled locally, but it's local water supplies that are in an issue. And what is interesting is I'm seeing concern about this from both Mexico and Argentina, where the Chinese are moving in to put more of these CAFOs, and they're trying to put it in the Yucatan Peninsula and there's something called the Tren Maya, which is basically to take the pork out. But this is a very interesting karst geology, where it means that waste is just going to go right down into what they call cenotes, which are their major sources of water. Mm-hmm. We have friends in Argentina that are also very worried about what this is going to make for their water quality. So this is a pan-national problem, and we got to be the first people to try it out and say, yeah, it works. And the other thing that's interesting with the master, you have to show you have land to put your manure on, but you don't have to do a soil test of your manure to see what nutrients and or which antibiotic resistant bacteria might be in your manure, because your hogs are fed antibiotics to increase their rate of growth, nor do you have to soil test the soil, the farmland, where you drive, and it's all within sort of like 15 miles or closer to where that lagoon is. So the more concentrated you have, the more that's going to run off through your farm tiles, just from runoff. And in fact, a lot of folks' drinking water and our ability to have alternative, and so even the hogs can't drink the water.
Oh, for goodness sakes.
I think it's interesting that in many areas that COVID-19 has really sort of laid bare the relationships that exist. And we certainly have seen that in the meatpacking industry. And so what we found was that these very large meatpacking firms just are not able to very quickly deal with social distancing and so forth. And probably even more important than that is that they have so much power that they pretty much did COVID-19 the way they wanted to do it, which was sacrificing their workers for profit.
Not only their workers, but since we have a lot of them in Iowa, it sacrificed the workers' family, the workers' communities, because it didn't just stay in the packing plants. It spread, a lot of rural communities, especially in Iowa and other Midwestern states. Our COVID percentages shot up because of this. So even if we're not the ones working in the plants, we are definitely affected by this.
So the other thing that happened was that the closure of some of those plants caused a real backup in the locker plants, because farmers were trying to get their animals sacrificed any way that they could, and we also, so there is another thing that we learned from COVID was that we really need to strengthen the role of small and medium-sized packing plants in order to have some degree of redundancy in the system. And it's parallel to what happened in the health system, in the sense that we were always working toward efficiency and we forgot to be concerned about redundancy.
And how we measure efficiency is very interesting. We only measure it in terms of who making money. And it all started with when we said the highest and best use of any business is to make profits for the stockholders. It didn't say anything about justice for the workers. It didn't say anything about making sure there's a living wage. It didn't say anything about producing healthy things. It didn't say anything about what goes on with the environment. And that has been very, very dangerous in terms of, you know, it was a Supreme Court decision pushed by Milton Friedman, and it's had some, again, very disastrous implications. I want to mention another area that our food supply is hit by. And recently, the nutrition guidelines, which made school lunches healthy for children, had been rolled back. And the idea was we're eliminating waste. Children don't like vegetables, so why feed them to them? And which meant more processed food on the menu. So we, on the one hand in Iowa, we've had these great farm-to-school movements. On the other hand, we've had pushing, with a lot of USDA support, processed food. And so we have very first, so it means we're reinforcing really bad eating habits. We have continuing problems of childhood obesity, and you can be obese and still have very bad nutrition. And we also then have this issue of what needs to really go on with our feeding programs. We've turned farmer food boxes into process that were distributed at the beginning of the COVID now have turned into just food boxes, again, full of highly processed food. So are we really helping? Well, obviously, we're helping families that it's better to eat than not to eat, but how can we make sure what people are eating is really a good thing?
Yes, this concept of well-being, that is a term that it's almost a new idea, especially when referred to government programs and the USDA. How much better would it be if well-being, health, was part of why we have government regulation? You mentioned something, Neil, about health of young mothers in Boston.
And one of the things we should recognize is that each group, when they migrate, often bring with them their traditional foods. And since they were self-provisioning, these were generally very varied diets, except from probably Ireland, because they were previously colonized by the English and were not allowed to raise diverse farming systems. But most everywhere else, people had their own kinds of vegetables, ways of cooking, combinations that were amazing. So what they found in this study, and they were really concerned about low birth weight babies, was that the difference between young women who had gave birth to low weight babies versus ones that were normal, survivable weight was grandmothers. And that was because these grandmothers who had migrated from the rural South to Baltimore kept growing what they grew in the rural South, which was growing what they grew in Africa. Many of the seeds which they had smuggled with them when they were kidnapped and brought here as slaves. So we had these diverse diets with all these great dark green leafy vegetables that the grandmothers fed their pregnant granddaughters, and the results were, again, multi-generational well-being.
So this is an official study, and yes, we can prove that sort of thing. I think that is amazing. That's good. I want to mention this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, and we're talking with Jan and Neil Flora about the USDA. So what the USDA does is important because they're the ones up on top, kind of using our tax dollars and deciding how we're going to do things. So what does what's up for the future?
Jan and Neil, who do you think should be running the USDA, or what kind of person at least, and what kind of background? Because it is, if it's going to be the people's department, we need a little bit more than just the subsidies for corn and soybeans that have been coming out of the USDA for way too long. What are your thoughts on how we could change this with the different kind of Secretary of Agriculture?
I think it's very interesting to go back to the beginning of the Obama administration. In the early part of Obama's first term, Neil was talking about GIPSA, or GIPSA, I'm not sure which it is.
GIPSA.
And Department of Agriculture, which was headed by Tom Vilsack, carried out hearings across the country about breaking up the large, particularly the large food processing companies.
Right. This is about monopolies in food processing, mainly animal food processing. Mm-hmm. We had a hearing, I think, in Ankeny. Even.
Yeah. Yeah, we had one in Iowa. I didn't remember where it was. And so those issues have surfaced before. But what was interesting was that when it really gained momentum and there was huge participation in those hearings, there was a lot of interest in bringing about a greater amount of diversity in the processing sector, particularly of animals. And But I don't know the full story, but the traditionalist ag interests, which certainly includes the Farm Bureau, got behind quashing that effort, and it simply died on the vine.
Yeah, it was funny because it was a big national dialogue, and a lot of farmers got to go to those listening sessions and give input, and it was quite clear that most of the farmers were not happy with this system, and then all of a sudden, boom, it was gone, it went nowhere, nothing happened.
So I think that's an interesting backdrop in which to discuss who will become Secretary of Agriculture. And right. As
what happened to Vilsack's watch.
Yeah. And so there are a number of candidates, or maybe more than we even know. But the initial front runner was Heidi Heitkamp, who was a Democratic senator from South Dakota who lost her seat, I think, in 2018, which was a Democratic year, but she lost in a difficult state. And she was pushed by Secretary Vilsack, who at least until recently was the number one. He basically had the ear of Joe Biden on agriculture.
And we're afraid now he's being reported again as a leading contender. But there are an awful lot, and Heidi is very much in the industrial ag, corn and soybean only camp.
And so, as I understand it, Jim Clyburn, who is in some senses responsible for Biden's good performance in South Carolina, which is where Clyburn is from, said, "Wait a minute, let's consider some African American or other minority people." And so that put forward a woman by the name of Martha Fudge, who is a member of Congress, and she's from Ohio, and she's on the House Ag Committee, and has been on it for quite a while. She's urban. Her main interests are in food issues, but my understanding is that she knows. She has learned quite a bit about agriculture. So I think she would be a very interesting candidate. Another person whose name has been mentioned is Arturo Rodriguez, who has run the United Farm Workers Organization I think he may have retired recently, but since the death of Cesar Chavez, he was the head of that organization. So he would bring an interesting Latino and farm worker orientation toward to the Secretary of Agriculture. There are some interesting candidates, and this push and pull between food and agriculture is very, very much in evidence. And we're a little bit worried that Vilsack's name is popping up again.
One of the people who worked with Vilsack and is, and Donna and I know because she was very active in sustainable agriculture circles early on, is Kathleen Merrigan. And she is a very interesting person to consider in terms of her background in concern for the land. So I think she would be also an interesting pick.
And she was number two under Vilsack in the, I think, in the first Obama administration.
Yeah. Kathleen Merrigan was also very instrumental in actually writing the organic standards, which are part of the USDA. So Kathleen has a lot of experience And if they're all looking at Vilsack and we want to go back to that sort of thing, maybe they should hop to the next generation and give Kathleen Merrigan a nod. Tell us, what would be the disadvantages of having a rehash with Vilsack going into this office once again?
Well, he is very comfortable with industrial agriculture. And I think he totally understands the export model. And I'm not sure he is, and I think with what's happening in milk, I don't think he understands the, you know, back in when we first started consolidation and land grabbing, it was also a period of industrialization, and there were jobs for people to go to. When we dispossess people now in terms of consolidation of land and of meat processing things, there are no jobs. So I think that mentality has got to shift. We can't just say it's more efficient. And I think Jan's notion of redundant, we're seeing our notion of let's be efficient with our hospitals and cut back on our emergency beds. And let's close those rural hospitals because they're not used to maximum potential. We're now seeing what that actually means for this other. So it sure saves a lot of money, but it sure costs a lot of lives. And we're seeing this really a problem in rural America.
And we talk about getting back to normal. Maybe the old normal needs a little bit of updating, and we can think about better as opposed to just going back to the way things were. Things are changing fast.
One other change I want to talk about is that possibly illegally, but two major USDA offices, the ones that measure things other than just bushels per acre, are the Economic Research Service and the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, were moved to Kansas City, Missouri, because it saved money. It also meant it lost 70% of the union workforce, because moving, just sort of picking up and moving from Washington, D.C. to Kansas City, Missouri, was not actually possible. That this whole notion of somehow there's just one job in a family, so we'll just move this person and the whole family will follow, turns out to be erroneous. And when you're in a city where there is good public transportation, the one where there is very poor public transportation, a whole lot of reasons why moving to Kansas City, Missouri, while a perfectly fine place, is not really easy to do at the drop of a hat. So we don't have the people we've lost from the Economic Research Service, which tells us not just how is financial capital doing, but what is happening with human capital, what is happening with communities, all that expertise has vanished. And they said, well, land-grant universities can do that work. Well, land-grant universities depend an awful lot on the data that comes from ERS and NIFA. So we really need to rethink this issue.
And I'm sorry, we have to wrap it up soon here, but I want to thank you guys for being with us. And it sounds like, as usual, there is a lot of work to do to get our agribusiness and agriculture agencies to think more about our well-being.
And this cabinet position is really, really critical. So let's all kind of keep our eye on this one.
Thank you to Jan and Neil Flora for talking about this issue with us. Thank you for being with us today.
You've been listening. And we're going to go and make some eggnog.
Great.
Good idea.
You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen. We had music today by the Barn Owl Band. Keep thoughtful. Wear your mask. Wash your hands. Be kind. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Fine engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.